Avalon Center's podcast, Responding with Hope, is paid for by the Department of Social Services. Avalon Center offers emergency shelter, individual and group counseling, and much more to survivors of domestic and sexual assault. If you need help, call our 24-hour hotline at 833-537-0970 or visit us at avaloncenter.org.
Hey guys, Leslie Jingluski here, and I'm with Avalon Center, and we are recording another episode of Responding with Hope. And today I'm super excited. I have Master Arlene Lemus here with me, and she is just super, we're super excited to have you. Let's talk real quick. I want to introduce you, and I want to talk a little bit about how we met to just kind of, you know, tap the water. And you and I have crossed paths a few times in the last few years. I have a son that is in Taekwondo, and he was fortunate enough to be able to train with you over here on the East Coast. And I just want to welcome you. Thank you so much for coming and agreeing to do this.
Oh, thank you very much. And it's always been a pleasure to cross your path. And I've had always fun times with your son while we train together. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit before we started recording that he's headed to the national championships this week. So he's in grumpy mode until we get there. So we'll just keep our mouths shut with each other until we get some food in him after.
Yeah. Once those weigh-ins are over, that's winning your, in my opinion, that's like winning your first fight. That's the ticket of it, the price of it, admission right there, those weigh-ins.
Yes, it is. And I joke all the time, it's his price of admission. And we pay the dollars of admission when we get him
right,
there.
Right.
But so, you know, Taekwondo has been in the news lately, and that it's so exciting because it is not usually in the news a whole lot. But tell me about what you think about our gold medal winner this year at the Olympics. It's so exciting.
Oh, I'm so excited for Anastasia. I mean, I think it was a great win. I hadn't realized that it had taken us so long to capture our first official gold medal in the women's division. We were a demonstration sport in 88 and 92. And so the win, Anastasia's win, didn't hit me until the announcer announced it, like, okay, this is our first official gold medal in the women's division. So, I mean, what a great, great thing for her.
I mean, it is, I'm getting chills just talking about it now because, and let's go ahead and talk about that because you were at the first year that the Taekwondo was a demonstration sport and you took home the gold medal. And I got to talk to you about it. I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you about it during the podcast. It's, I can't imagine that you could put words to what that feels like, but I want to hear you try.
I mean, I'm sure every Olympian is, excited about their experience at the Olympic Games, win, lose, or draw. You know, it's just the idea of participating in that event. It's just such a special event and such a special fraternity to be a part of. If you get the chance and the luxury to participate in the Olympic Games. But I think the ADA team in particular was just something special for us to be able to represent the United States in Korea, the birthplace of Taekwondo, and represent USA. And knowing the importance of USA having a good showing at that games had an impact on the future of Taekwondo becoming an official sport. So yeah, it was, in addition to the event and the competition of itself, everything else that was so meaningful around it, just incredible, an incredible, journey for me. I fell in love with the Olympic Games, watching Nadia Comaneci and Olga Korbut in the 80 games. And then the 84 games, of course, created a whole new buzz because it was a games in the United States. But yeah, I've always been a fan of the Olympic Games. And when Taekwondo was accepted in, it was just amazing for me.
I can only imagine. And I was doing a little bit of, you know, well, this research was done long before this podcast, but you were such an underdog going into that, that they didn't even have the national anthem to play when you were on the podium. And the story that you started singing and everybody joined in gives me chills, almost brings a tear to my eye, because I cannot imagine the empowerment that you must have felt standing on that podium at that moment. It didn't even matter. It was almost better that they didn't have it, because it just made such a statement.
Yeah, it was a pretty special moment. And, you know, I don't know what the real story is or the true story is, if there was a glitch with the equipment or if they really were so sure that Korea was going to win. Mm-hmm. I was a bit of a nobody in the Taekwondo community. So I'm not sure why the music didn't play, but when it didn't play and the flags were almost completely risen, you know, because Taekwondo was the first event, the first day of competition, you know, it's hard to get to see a final. You usually have to see a preliminary, and then maybe you see a quarter, and then maybe you see a final, you know, 5 days later or something.
Sure.
But in Taekwondo, we fought all that in one day. Mm-hmm. So people who were lucky enough to get a ticket for Taekwondo, you know, were very excited. They could watch a competition in its entirety for the whole weight division. And there were a lot of military, U.S. military there, you know, because of the presence of the U.S. military in South Korea. A lot of military came from Yongsan Army Base, and we had trained at Yongsan Army Base leading up to the Olympic Games. So, I mean, I almost felt a little bit like having a home field advantage. There were so many Americans in the stands. And when the music didn't play, we just started singing. I looked over to my family and my friends, and we were like, oh no, we are not going to not hear our anthem. We're going to hear our anthem. And we just started singing.
Oh my gosh. It's still, I've heard this story so many times, never from you, but it gives me chills to this day. And I'm with you. The Olympics is something special because it is just, and we can go back to Anastasia for a second, and on all of the pictures I've seen of you online and the win, there is something about that genuine pride and excitement and empowerment and all wrapped up into one that even the best actors in the world can't fake. And I think, you know, there's a picture floating around of her, and there's so many pictures of you, and they are so genuine and humbling, I guess is the best word for that, because I just, that's the Olympics. That's what it brings.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, of course you go in there. I'm sure Anastasia went in there like, I am the best. This is my time to win. But until your hand is raised, it's not confirmed that you're the best and that you're going to win. So there is that rush of emotion and like, yes, I did it. You know, when your hand is ultimately raised.
And oh my gosh, I know. And I can imagine that adrenaline that just is there and then falls, and the emotions and everything culminates into that one moment. It's breathtaking, even for somebody like me, who's just, you know, behind the 15-year-old, I'm the mom behind the scenes pushing him along, but it's emotional.
Yes, it is.
But then you left the Olympics you didn't leave the Olympics, or you moved on to a different chapter, and that was coaching and mentoring. And you certainly are for my son. So what did that mean to you afterwards, and the experience that you brought to the table? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, after the Olympic Games, I fought for a few years after, and my goal at that point was to win a world championships, because at that time, the Olympic Games was a closed division of 16 competitors.
Okay.
So the physical world championships was what much more physically grueling. So my next goal was to become a world champion, which I did. Yes. In 91 in Greece. And then following that, I mean, I had always been teaching and coaching. I started teaching in my garage in Chicago. So even at 14 years old, I was already teaching. And it just came very natural to me. I enjoyed it and I learned a lot from teaching. So if I had to, I think I was fortunate to be very athletic, but sometimes when you're so athletic, your body just does things and you don't know really why they work.
Right.
So once you start teaching and you have to explain to someone like, hey, this is how the roundhouse kick works. And you have to think about what you're doing. Oh, I'm pivoting as I'm coming up. I'm extending my leg. So there's this whole different approach, which then in turn, you can internalize and make your round kick better as you're teaching it. So teaching was really a gift for me. Teaching and coaching really turned out to be a gift for me. Mm-hmm. And then when I retired, I just, to tell you the truth, as corny as it sounds, I just wanted people to feel what I had been fortunate enough to feel.
Right.
To feel what it feels like to train towards a goal, reach that goal, set another goal. You know, the lessons learned from the triumphs and the defeats. I just, that's all I wanted. I knew for me, it made me a better person. And I wanted to impart that to my martial arts students and my athletes.
It is the martial arts and the empowerment that it offers is, I throughout my career and throughout my high school, I was more of a dancer and more of a different type of athlete because it is somewhat of an athleticism. But martial arts brings a confidence, and I have seen it in my child that I cannot, I can't really put into words. You would be better at that. But it is an empowerment and a confidence that will carry them through the rest of the life. And it has to be so exciting to be a part of that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, what I think happens to martial arts, beside all the history and the tradition that martial art brings as a activity, mm-hmm. I think there is a certain type of strength that comes, a certain type of empowerment that comes from feeling that power in your body, mm-hmm. and then projecting that in a strike. Or being able to defend yourself from a strike. There's just a different kind of empowerment that comes from that physical education, that muscle memory that you get from martial arts. It's just different. And it's, I'll say, not only martial arts, other combatives can offer that too, boxing, wrestling. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they have the history of the martial arts respect and the tenets that martial arts brings. But that feeling powerful in your body is pretty awesome.
It is. And I tell people all the time with martial arts, sitting, you know, I have friends who have children that are in baseball and sitting aside. And when you talk about that tenets, it in that respect and that, composure, you know, our kids, people from the outside who haven't been involved will say, I mean, you're sending your kid off to fight. And I'm like, you know what? Yes, I am. But rarely do I see parents on the sideline going at each other. It is 3 minutes, 4 minutes of fighting. And then at the end, everybody shakes hand and there is a respect among the other parents and everybody there. Occasionally there's an exception, but for the most part, what I have seen and I have children in other sports, it's different. On the sideline, the parents respect each other. Whereas that may not be the case sometimes in Little League baseball or soccer or whatever have you.
It's definitely something different. And I hope it stays that way. Sometimes I worry that becoming an Olympic sport, we're losing our martial art portion. Right. But I hope it stays that way. I think it still has the potential to be something very special as a martial art and as a sport.
I agree. So let's switch, you know, with Avalon and everything, let's kind of redirect a little bit. Let's talk about your work. Well, we'll get there, but I want to talk about the culture that as we're kind of moving into sports in general, when did you come to that realization that there was, and really, I said it before, a lack of a better word, a culture of predatory coaches and athletes, really? I mean, when did you see that in the
sport? Well, I mean, I guess I saw it at a very young age, and it wasn't presented to me kind of as something that was wrong until I got older. But, you know, throughout the martial arts community, you'd always see, you know, this older instructor now traveling with, you know, a younger athlete. Maybe that athlete or student has been their student since they were, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old. But now when they're 16, you know, the instructor and the student are now dating, you know, so there was kind of, that was seemed to be the norm. Now, remember, I started martial arts in 71.
Okay.
So, you know, it was quite a long time ago when the idea of sexual harassment or inappropriate relationships, they weren't being questioned probably across our whole society. So, you know, as things started to change, I started to notice more. Or when I'd see coaches or instructors disregard that student all of a sudden, and there'd be someone new. And I thought, right. Well, this doesn't seem right. This just seems like a pattern to me that, you know, when they're done with this poor student, now there's a new younger athlete or student on their arm. And then that student who was an incredible martial artist or as incredible athlete would now quit.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be this norm and it seemed to be accepted, you know, even on, you know, on the 88 team, there were, you know, inappropriate relationships. So it was something that I found myself just kind of organically going to those athletes and saying, hey, are you okay? You don't have to go there. You can go with me. We can go for a walk over here. You don't have to go to that coach's room just because that coach is telling you to go to that room.
Right.
So, you know, that type of behavior, unfortunately, although I feel it's changing and it has changed in the last several years, that was very common behavior within the sport of Taekwondo. And then I later found out, of course, as we all did on the news and in other ways, that this inappropriate dynamic, this power dynamic between coach and athlete has taken, you know, bad turns over and over and over and over again.
And the trauma that was there, I don't think we know 100% of the trauma. I think as a society, we said earlier in the podcast, price of admission. And that hurts me to say that out loud, especially doing what I do. But when the culture and everything is different, what strength it must have been for somebody in that culture to say, hey, you know what? I'm talking about you. You don't have to go there. You can come with me.
Right. Yeah.
That kind of strength is what I hope that I teach my children, my son. I like to say all the time, I hope my sons learn how to treat other people. I hope my sons know how to be treated. I hope my daughter knows how to be treated. And I hope my daughter can stand up for herself when she's not being treated and know what's inappropriate. So that's when we get to healthy relationships and really that prevention piece.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important. And, you know, although it's become something that has been that's now in the forefront and we're discussing it, I am still not convinced that athletes at the highest level, and if it's not happening at the highest level, it's definitely not happening at the grassroots level. I'm not convinced that they're given those tools to identify inappropriate coercion. They're not given those tools to set a boundary. They're not given the tools to be a good bystander and know what the process is on how to report something. So although we've got better and there's awareness now, I'm not quite sure where we should be.
Absolutely not. I agree with you 100%. I think that there's still a fear of, I've worked my whole life for this. I just need to do what I need to do to get there.
Athletes in general, we are conditioned, and if we're successful, the reason we got to be successful is because we were able to shake things off and get back up and throw off a bad workout so that we could get into the second workout of the day and be productive. So it's, you know, we're conditioned to do that. Just shake it off. And now if you add into it a coach who you love that guy or you love that woman, this coach, you have been, you know, together, you have achieved, you have persevered together. And now it's now been compromised. You don't stop loving that person. You don't stop respecting that person. You don't stop, you know, wanting to have that person close to you and involved in your success. You still want that.
Sure.
So imagine all those torn feelings of, I know this is wrong. Okay, let's go through my checklist. If I say something, I'm going to lose a coach that I love. If I say something, I'm going to lose a team and my support group that I love. If I say something, I'm going to lose my opportunity at success that I've worked so hard at in my sport. If I say something, they might not even believe me. So all these things happen. So it's quite a pickle that athletes who are, you know, in these situations deal with. And imagine if you're young.
Right. I can't. I think I told you this a little bit before, but when I talk to, we do a program at Avalon called In Her Shoes, and that focuses more on inner partner relationships. And I get the question all of the time, and I told you before, it drives me crazy. I have a love-hate relationship with the question, because they'll say, well, I don't understand why she doesn't just leave. And I too, at one point in my life, was probably guilty of having that you know, assumption and project those feelings. But the answer to that is so complicated that luckily there are people out there who are fortunate enough not to understand. And if that makes sense, because, you know, the better question is, why is the abuser abusing?
Exactly.
Yes, but we're so conditioned as a society to question, you know, you put all of the question and therefore you're not realizing it, but you're putting the blame on the survivor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we definitely need to change the way we phrase that, right? Like,
right.
You know, the stats we keep are, you know, women who have been impacted by rape or women who've been impacted by sexual assault. And just the way we kind of word that, it needs to be shifted. And men who are perpetrating rapes, and the statistics should be men who are perpetrating sexual assaults, or people who are perpetrating sexual assaults. You know, we definitely we need to change that verbiage. That's for sure.
We do. And, you know, it's a slow process. You know, I use this term all of the time when we deal with our boats, small corrections. Big corrections, you end up overcorrecting and going the other way. But small corrections, and that's hard when you're dealing with something as sensitive as we are. But, you know, I can imagine the same with the sporting and with the athletes. You know, you're trained in combat. You are trained to defend yourself. You have the muscle memory and everything to defend yourself. And no, but like you pointed out before, it's complicated. There's more than just the physical assault. There's more lost there than just that. And it's
yeah. And that's what brought me to the community that I'm working within now, and hoping to spread through paid prevention. It's the empowerment self-defense community. So empowerment self-defense has been around for 50 years, probably more, even more than that, but it's never quite become mainstream. It's in these small pockets around the world doing great work and changing people's lives, but never on the scale that I think it should be. And I was doing some work. I've always known the people involved with empowerment self-defense, and I was involved with an incubator to create a global organization to grow empowerment self-defense. And while I was involved in the incubator, it was the same time when we were going through a really dark period with USA Taekwondo and everything coming forward about assaults and rapes on our female team members from predatory coaches and predatory athletes. And so it hit me while I was involved in this that, you know what, these are people, these are athletes, Taekwondo athletes slash martial artists who can protect themselves physically against anyone. I mean, they are the cream of the crop. They are the top of the top.
Exactly.
If you see them in the ring, they are formidable, but they're still being assaulted. They're still being raped. So it's really not so much about the physical skills, although you need your physical skills as well. Mm-hmm. It's more about the intangibles. It's more about having the tools to recognize certain behavior, having the tools to go, this coercion is inappropriate. There's a different coercion between you want me to fight one more round and a coercion that you want me to stay late at your apartment. You know, there's a different dynamic there between coach and athlete. And, you know, we just weren't giving them those skills, where empowerment self-defense does give those skills. So then I started formulating curriculum and formulating things that could be then administered to an athlete and then anyone at that point. So that's what pulled me into the empowerment self-defense world, and now to take the helm of paid prevention, which is trying to take those skills, package those skills, and take those skills to the corporate level, to the employee level, where we know employees may not be as productive as they could be. They may not be the best boss or the best coworker if they are dealing with violent events or if there are violent situations at work. And when I say violence, I don't only mean, you know, rape or an assault or something like that. It's all those microaggressions that can pick at you every day that make you less productive.
Right. Right. And I love the productivity piece of it. Because we talk so much about prevention, and at Avalon, we're kind of steering our, we've had this, we respond for so many years, and it's, we do respond. We will always respond. But I think in our strategic planning right now, we are switching gears and we're moving towards prevention, which is hard to measure. Hard to measure prevention because there's so many factors. You know, you talk about, well, yeah, if you have to respond less, but I think when we start with prevention and education, I think as we head that direction, our response rates are going to need to be even more, because you have that, you have more education and people saying, you know what, this is not okay. I need help. I need somebody to talk me through this. I need somebody to talk to me about safety planning. So, you know, while you talk about prevention, I think you have that lull where maybe, you know, it looks like your productivity is going down, but in the big picture, you're working towards a goal that is everybody's goal. It's just right. Not non-political. There's no political affiliation with wanting to be better and wanting us as a society to be better.
I think our ideas about prevention also need to change, because we've been trying these same approaches and we haven't seen the impact that we'd like to see. So for example, right, you know, there are issues out in the parking lot at night. A couple people have reported not feeling safe going to their car. I mean, the approach, it turns into, okay, let's add more lights, or, you know, let's close the stores an hour earlier. It's never empowering the person to feel better about walking into that parking lot. And that's where I think we need to start putting our funds, our support, our training. That's where that needs to go. Give the person the skills to feel comfortable walking in that parking lot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Give them the skills to do it. And then as a result, I will see those. I think you'll see less and less perpetrators.
Yep.
Absolutely. And it's not always violent. You know, there's lots of tips and things that you can do to protect yourself. Obviously, you need to learn to protect yourself if, you know, physically if needed, but there, I'm sure you guys have ways to protect yourself before a combat begins, or before, you know, physical altercations, I guess is the word.
I was having a discussion with someone, and someone pointed up an article that they had read. I wish I had the name of it now, but there's something like 13 small steps or microaggressions that they have researched and tallied that lead up to a physical confrontation.
Wow.
So if we can stop it at number 2, or we could stop it at number 10, maybe we'd never get to that assault. Maybe we never get to that rape.
Right. Right. And little things as we're talking, and then, you know, if it does, if you get to that 13th aggression, our coach, Craig Simpson, does a female self-defense class that I have had the honor of taking a few times. And it is, it little things that you don't think of, and he'll do an exercise where he'll say, you know, I'm going to try to take your flip-flop, you know, if I'm wearing flip-flops, because he's trying to take something from you. And, you know, that's, you're protecting, he's giving you something to protect. And I'll never forget us doing this and him coaching me through it and hit me in my face, hit me, you know, he's wearing gear. And then we got to the end and he said, now, how long do you think that was? And I said, oh gosh, like 6 or 7 minutes. And he said, Leslie, it was 32 seconds. And honestly, my adrenaline had got going because I was protecting my flip-flop, not my virtue, my flip-flop. But your adrenaline, it was interesting because in defending myself, or defending my flip-flop, my adrenaline, I was dog tired. I was done. I was done. So all of the, like you said, if we can stop it at the second aggression,
yep,
not the 13th, to where you get right to the point.
If we can, you know, give somebody the tools in an office space, right, to recognize that, oh, okay, this person, my boss, has brought up my sex life numerous times. Something's not right here.
Right.
You know, if we could give them just, because believe it or not, some people don't get those cues. And some people, you know, there's that power dynamic, you know, is something they need to be given that checklist, that toolkit, to avoid those situations and go, something's not right. And something that I find always surprises me how many people don't trust their intuition.
Right.
You know, so learning to trust your intuition, and there are a lot of exercises we do with that, you know, there's an exercise we use called the stoplight exercise, where it's red, yellow, green, just like a stoplight.
Right.
And we go over different scenarios. We present different scenarios. Okay, so is this a green light scenario? You don't have to worry about it. There's nothing to be concerned about. And then we discuss it. For some people, it may be a green. For some people, it might be already a yellow. So based on your own comfort zone, and then, okay, no, this is definitely a red. This is a red situation. You know, my spidey senses are telling me this is a red situation and I should take myself out of this. I mean, trusting your intuition is very, very important.
And we, yes, We teach that too. And trusting your children's intuition. If your child says, you know, I don't want to be around that person. I don't know why. I don't want to. There is an animalistic instinct of protection that we all have. Sometimes it's buried so deep in our social settings, but it's there, and it's there for a reason. For your body to alert that there's danger. And I think you're right. I think we need to dive into that. And I think we need to listen to that instinct, because it's a protective instinct that we need to all understand.
Yeah. And I think another thing, when we talk about productivity or being a better mom or being a better boss or being a better sibling, is if we have suffered from a violent event, or we have suffered from one of these assaults, or even a family member has suffered from one of those things, we need to heal, and we need to have the tools to feel empowered to heal.
Right.
So I think that this type of training, empowerment self-defense training, can help people regain their power, you know, feel strong in their body again. And I think it's really important.
This is all through PAVE, and obviously you're going to be offering it in the Chicago area. Is that where you're headed?
Well, actually we're headquartered here in Chicago, but we're a worldwide organization. So we're in the process of developing pilot programs and pilot presentations. We're in beta testing mode right now. Mm-hmm. We may be in Burundi and Rwanda and Costa Rica and Chicago. We're a worldwide organization, but yeah, that's where we're at. And the pilot possibilities are already being generated worldwide.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. If you had to guess, when do you think, you know, a pilot would be launched?
Well, our goal is at least 4 by the end of the year. So,
wow.
That's still our goal. Hopefully our first one will be in September. And so I will make sure that you see information on that. I'm sure there'll be some media and some press releases on it as well, but I'll make sure that you get the information on it.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I didn't realize it was that quickly. That's awesome.
Yeah, right. We are focusing on two sectors although we're open to all sectors, the two sectors that we're focusing on right now is the healthcare sector. And with you being at Avalon, that should ring true, the healthcare sector and the service sector, because we feel those two sectors almost on a daily basis could benefit from the skill set. That's what we're focused on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The healthcare sector has been through so much this year.
Yes.
And I'm afraid we might be headed back a little bit, but the healthcare and I, my history before working at Avalon was in healthcare. So having the ability to be trauma-informed, and of course they're trauma-informed, but having that extra tool in your toolkit to be able to identify these things and protect yourself. So, you know, it would work as an advocate and as an employee. I'm so excited to hear from PAVE and all the work that you're doing. And
I think we have the potential to do something really special and to really impact what the work culture looks like. What looks like going forward. Mm-hmm. And I think the time, given everything the world has gone through, I think this is the right time to start talking about this. And, you know, I think as people go back to work and they find themselves back in the workplace, they're not looking for the same old things that they were looking for 2 years ago.
Right.
I think that there will be an appreciation for companies and organizations that offer this type of training and this type of support, to you know, to their employees. I think it'll be very meaningful. You know, we envision, you know, everyone looking to be PAVE compliant, everybody looking to go through PAVE training. That's what we're hopeful for.
I can't wait. And I have no doubt that PAVE compliant will be common lingo sooner than later.
That'd be awesome. That would be awesome.
I can hear it. You know, I can manifest it for you. I'll try. but it is, you know, being PAVE compliant. I love the sound of that. And I love what it stands for. And again, like I said before, it's the right thing to do. And that's the bottom line. It's Chicago. I know you have family in Chicago, and that's kind of where we miss you here, though. We miss you so much, but your future plans. And when I read the article of what you were doing with PAVE, I just thought, you know, that's perfect. That is absolutely perfect. And sometimes timing and everything falls into one's lap just as it should.
You know, it's I've been very fortunate, and that's kind of how my life has fallen. You know, even if things looked really weird while I was going through it, but when I put some distance from that event, it really showed itself on why it happened and why it happened that way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I really feel like this is what I'm supposed to be doing at this time. So I'm incredibly excited about it.
I'm excited for you. And I would love to facilitate Avalon being PAVE compliant at some point soon.
Well, we might circle back and put you on our pilot list. Yes. That'd be awesome.
That would be wonderful. And, you know, I said something to one of our counselors at Avalon the other day when I was talking to her about you and PAVE. And I mean this from the bottom of my heart. When I'm around you, it makes me want to be a better person. And I hope that you continue to do everything that you're doing, because we need you. And I think domestic violence and sexual assault, which is my wheelhouse and everything that we deal with. Until that doesn't exist anymore, we need people at the forefront doing what they know how to do, and you're basing all of this on science-based evidence, or just, you know, yes. I love that. I love that you're in beta testing, and that I think that's the only way we're going to make a change in the culture that unfortunately we live in. And like you said, it's getting better. It is getting better, but that does not mean, just because it's getting better doesn't mean we stop having the conversation.
No, and it started on that path because of awareness.
Exactly. You know?
So we have to just keep creating that awareness. And then, you know, a friend of mine within the self-defense and empowerment self-defense community, you know, says all the time, self-defense has to be completely narrowed down to, can I take it in the shower with me?
Right.
So that's it. All your, when it comes down to it, your skill set has to be you. You have to embody your skill set. Because, you know, you can't rely on an app, you can't rely on a whistle, you can't rely on all these other things that may or may not work. You can only rely on yourself.
That is, yes. And when you can rely on yourself, when you decide that you are important enough and that you are powerful enough to rely on yourself, it answers so many questions. It answers so many problems. It is a solution, just in mindset alone.
Yeah. Yep.
So, well, I appreciate you more than you'll know. And, this has been a great podcast. Anything else that you would like us to know, or?
No, I mean, I just appreciate the opportunity to, you know, discuss, you know, what I'm doing these days and how excited I am about it. And, you know, just, you know, I'm just trying to continually put it out there that, you know, this is what we're doing and, you know, be a part of it. Cause I think we can have a really huge impact.
I think we can too. And that's where your community engagement comes in too. I think you need advocates and in every state and every, you know, you need advocates at the hospital level for PAVE. And I think that's how, as an organization, you're going to get there. And I have no doubt, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But, it's very exciting. It's I think going to be more productive than Six Sigma. And that was a big one for a while. So
We're going to do it.
I don't doubt that for a single solid second in my brain. I know it's coming and I'm happy to be the one of the first ones to talk to you about it.
Yeah. Great. I appreciate the opportunity.
Avalon Center's podcast, Responding with Hope, is paid for by the Department of Social Services. Avalon Center offers emergency shelter, individual and group counseling, and much more to survivors of domestic and sexual assault. If you need help, call our 24-hour hotline at 833-537-0970 or visit us at avaloncenter.org.